5 minutes after 1:00, the Resource Committee is in session. Our agenda today is to address two bills, a joint resolution, a presentation by Northern Dynasty, and then a few comments if the time's available for the Pumpkin Festival that's going to be held next fall. First up is House Bill 300, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission members, and Vic Coring, and just for ease today, Ralph's just going to let me have the gavel through this. We don't anticipate this is especially controversial. So with that, Representative Coring.
Never can tell.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to have you. You're always so kind to me when I attend your oil and gas meetings, so I'm real honored to have you here, and the floor is yours, and we're going to do whatever you tell us to.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you very much for those kind remarks. It's an honor to be in your presence as well, and I appreciate our great working relationship. And thank you, members of the committee, including Co-Chair Samuels, for hearing House Bill 300. I'm Vic Coring. I represent House District 14, which is the greater Wasilla area. I'm here to present this legislation, which makes a modification to current statute in terms of the public seat that the governor appoints to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. As you might know, there's three members that are appointed to that commission, two of which require a geologist and petroleum engineering background. However, the third one doesn't require any kind of petroleum background, so hence the reason for this legislation. We feel, given the complexity of the oil and gas industry and increasingly getting more complex in light of the improved and advanced technology that we're seeing, as well as the just the expansion in the industry, the continued growth that we're seeing, we feel that that third position ought to have at least some oil and gas background. We're not saying that that person ought to have the high level of expertise as, say, a geologist or petroleum engineer would have, but we feel that it shouldn't be a completely wide open slot that doesn't require any kind of petroleum experience. So what we've done is we've struck kind of a middle ground balance between one that has the expertise and one that has nothing by just simply putting generic language in the bill here that requires an oil and gas background. So that's essentially the nature of the bill, just to make sure that that individual has experience and that doesn't have to start with zero experience and have to learn on the job. This shouldn't be an on-the-job training situation. It ought to be somebody that knows the industry reasonably well and therefore can fulfill their responsibilities adequately and understand the technical nature of the industry and be able to apply their skills accordingly to the position. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Coring, before we take any questions, I'm remiss. I failed to introduce or to announce the members that are present. Representative Gatto is here, Chair Samuels, myself, Chair Ramirez, Vice Chair Seaton, Representative Elkins, and Representative Ledoux are in attendance, and Representative Kapsner and Representative Olson, I believe, are both excused from the body. I know Representative Olson is attending our friend Mike Chenault's mother's funeral, and I'm sure we all take a moment to feel for his loss. It's, to lose your mom's tough thing. With that, we're happy to open things up for questions for Representative Coring. Representative Ledoux?
What is this going to do to the current member who is on the board who does not have training?
Okay. That individual is Mr. Norman, who's the chairman, and a very adept individual who's doing a great job, I might add. It has no effect on his position. It would be the individuals appointed thereafter upon the conclusion of his term. And I might add that Mr. Norman, I believe, is online or is scheduled to be. And also in your packet, if I may, Mr. Chairman, there's a letter that's signed by all three commissioners supporting this legislation who feel it's a good concept. Mr. Norman, as well as Dan Seamount and Kathy Forrester.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Coring. And Mr. Norman will be testifying. He will be online here shortly. Representative Ledoux?
Has there been a problem in the past that made somebody think about doing this?
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you asking that question. I anticipated that. No, there has not been, to my knowledge. In fact, people that have been appointed that filled that public seat have done a fine job, in my opinion. However, we're just looking to the future and making sure that we don't have a problem. But we're also anticipating increased growth in terms of the technical expertise of the way the industry is becoming with increased technology. The fact that it requires a highly technical analysis of the data. You got to really understand your stuff to be able to really know your job and to be able to perform your responsibilities. And then with the industry growing as it is, not just in complexity, but in terms of just sheer volume of work, it's requiring that these three commissioners look at more and more applications and being inundated with lots of information.
Excellent. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I have one question that is in the state, the requirement that they're familiar with oil and gas industry in the state. I noticed that that's not a requirement on either the geologist or the petroleum engineer. Is that going to be more restrictive on the public member than it is on either a petroleum geologist, a petroleum engineer, or a geologist?
What the public position requiring to have knowledge of oil industry operations in the state?
That's
and the other two do not have that stipulation?
Is that to the chair, yes.
That's okay. I don't really know how to answer that question. Perhaps I can pose that one to Mr. Norman, if you don't mind.
I guess if I could follow up.
Please.
And if, you know, I understand the necessity to have someone have the background in the oil industry, but it might be that unless that's a particularly criteria that you're need to put in, maybe you could address if you would mind taking that out, because
okay.
that would mean that a public member who had experience and training in oil and gas was here but hadn't had that training
I understand what you're saying.
Would then still be qualified to sit on the.
I wasn't trying to duck the question. I guess I just didn't fully comprehend what you were asking, but I'd be amenable to making that tweak if that would help to clarify things better. And frankly, I think if somebody had a solid background from another state, because oil and gas industry is quite similar regardless of where you're at in terms of drilling for oil and gas and producing such. So if somebody came from the Colorado School of Mines or whatever the name of that reputable institution is that trains mining and petroleum engineers, and they came to Alaska without experience per se here, I still think they would be qualified. But
okay.
I'd be happy to tighten that up.
Thank you.
Sure.
Chair Samuels?
Thank you. I don't know if Representative Corn or Representative Seaton, I think I would, knee-jerk reaction would be disagree, but leave it in. Geology is geology no matter where in the world you are. Rock is a rock. Political boundaries don't matter. But in Alaska, we unitize things differently than Texas. It's all now, the land's mostly owned by the state as opposed to private landholders, and so it is a little bit different animal. So if you're not going to bring something to the table on the sciences, you probably ought to bring something to the table on how our tax system works as opposed to, I mean, we're different. And I think every jurisdiction is different, whether it be, you know, Kazakhstan or Texas or Deepwater Gulf. I think if we're going to have some public member in there, you probably should bring something to the table on the way that we do business, whether it be taxes or unitization or drilling techniques in the Arctic as opposed to drilling techniques in Texas. Something. If you can bring something to the table, geology is a little bit different. Geology is just geology. Mm-hmm. So that's throw my two cents in.
Okay.
Friend Representative Crawford has joined us. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Gatto?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is there some, I'm going to ask the question, but first, one is a petroleum engineer, one is a geologist. Mm-hmm. Both of these people are engineers, technically trained, know a lot about drilling.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost think a third person ought to be a manager of some kind, a businessman, someone who really can reach across and understand how we get money from Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
this is the job that Sarah Palin had?
It is, yes.
Okay. And I guess some other people that we would probably recognize.
Have. Yes.
And now it's filled by Mr. Norman and what's the other name?
The other names are Dan Seamount and Kathy Forrester.
Okay. And either of those trained specific or have at least some exposure to business management?
To mine, I don't have knowledge. It very well could be, but I do not have knowledge of that. All I know is that Seamount is trained. I forget which is which. One of the two is the geologist, the other is the petroleum engineer. And as far as Mr. Norman's background, I understand that he's an attorney.
Yeah, see, that's
very business
helpful.
Management,
yeah.
I do not know.
And then one more question, sir?
Certainly.
Thank you. Fundamental understanding is a general term.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody here has a fundamental understanding. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that would differentiate too much based on what you want to sell somebody that has an extraordinary understanding,
mm-hmm.
maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make that comment. Yeah. That,
all right.
Because that is the language that was changed here. training or experience. Thank you.
Are there any more questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really apologize for not having been here sooner. And I just wanted to hear your explanation as to why you wouldn't want a public member mm-hmm. on the Oil and Gas Commission. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that when Ms. Palin was mm-hmm. on the commission, that she did a fine job mm-hmm. of actually looking out for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what was the original reasoning for mm-hmm. putting a public member that, mm-hmm. that had no connection to the oil and gas mm-hmm. business.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like that was a good idea at the time,
yeah.
and why should we change that?
Yes. I just think that individual should have the expertise given the highly technical nature of the data that they have to analyze and the fact that the industry is not a growing complexity, but there's just an increasingly large volume of work, and that certainly that person, even if they had an extensive background in petroleum, geology, engineering, they could still advocate for the public's interests. I would just have to state that I think it's really important, given the nature of the job and the significant responsibility, that person doesn't go into this thing with no knowledge and has to learn from the, I hate to say, seat of their pants, but goes in without, has to start from scratch and not know the industry going into it. I think it would behoove the state and us as the legislature to make sure that individual has some fundamental knowledge of the industry.
Follow up?
Oh, certainly.
So when I came to this seat, there were an awful lot of issues that I had no fundamental knowledge of whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
but I'm still a representative of the people,
mm-hmm.
and it was up to me to try to get informed on the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And make a informed decision regarding all these issues, whether it's oil and gas or limits on trucking loads.
Mm-hmm.
There are just a lot of things that you and I and the rest of us have to try to make informed decisions
mm-hmm.
on.
Yeah.
I think that there oil and gas industry, you know, when you're employed and a part of that industry, that you develop mindsets mm-hmm. and a culture within that industry. And I think that was the reason why we originally had one member that was not a part of that mm-hmm. corporate culture.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. We're not indicating that the person should have employment per se within the industry, and of course, chances are if they've studied engineering or geology or some aspect of petroleum, mineral petroleum technology, that they would work in the industry, but we're not making that a requirement. So I'm not certain that individual would have a certain mindset that they would be just totally pro-development. But I might ask or mention, Mr. Chairman, that I'd be more than happy to entertain an amendment to require that legislators, at least from his House district, have experience before he runs for office. I say that tongue-in-cheek. Or my district too, if you want to add that. House District 14, you can add that, just to be fair, okay?
Boy, the chair really needs to absorb that. Representative Ledoux.
Do we have a number of other public commissions in this state in which the public members don't have any before they're appointed, mm-hmm. are not required to have a fundamental understanding of the?
I would say the answer is yes, and I'm going to have to be brutally honest with you here. I actually was in a situation where I was appointed to a board and didn't require experience on the Alaska Housing Board 15 years ago, And I can speak by personal experience in saying that was a tough challenge for me. As much as I was honored by the governor at Hickel at that time to appoint me, and as much as I was excited to be on that board and worked really hard, boy, it took me a while to get up to speed and before I really honestly felt I was an effective member of that board. I had no housing experience per se other than hanging drywall in houses and painting houses. So that's the only example I can think of. So the answer is yes. I don't know to what extent, though.
And did you get up to speed?
I did. It took me a while, though, because it was a very complex board, and there was a lot of issues and a lot of programs involved that were not simplistic in nature.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. I'm just curious about the job description of the commission itself. The fact is that we have a petroleum engineer and a geologist, but actually, why does a person have to know engineering or geology to serve on the commission? So what I'm asking is, what is the commission charged to do? Is it to approve contracts? Is it to maintain? I don't know. I guess I'm asking what they do.
I would, if it's all right, Representative Gatto, as well as the co-chairs, I'd like to, I'm not trying to duck the question, and I can go through my notes here, but Mr. Norman, which I understand is online, who serves on that commission, would be able to easily answer that. I'd like to, if it's all right, have him do so.
May I interrupt for a moment? Mr. Norman is on the line, and he has a 1:30 appointment, so we would only have him for a few minutes. If you would sit tight.
Sure. Be pleased to.
Please, Representative Coring, if we could go to Mr. Norman and pose any questions that we might have of him, and then we can come back to the bill sponsor. Mr. Norman, are you with us?
I am with you. Are you able to hear me all right?
We hear you very well. If you'd introduce yourself and your position for the record, please, and then if you have a short statement, then we'd be delighted to pepper you with questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Norman. I'm the current chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I was appointed and confirmed by the legislature roughly 2 years ago, so I've been in this position for about 2 years now. With me also and available to respond to any questions that you all might have is Commissioner Dan Seamount and Commissioner Kathy Forrester. As was indicated, Commissioner Seamount is the geologic commissioner and Commissioner Forrester is the engineering commissioner. I want to mention first that ordinarily I would be there before you on a bill like this affecting the commission, and I hope it would not be interpreted as any disrespect to you, but we have a very significant matter set for hearing, and it has been for some time, and that's set to start at 1:30 today, and hence the need to participate by phone. We do appreciate the opportunity to comment on the bill and to be allowed to participate, and we thank the committee for that and Representative Coring and all members of the committee. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is one of the oldest regulatory agencies in the state of Alaska. It started before statehood, and it's an example of remarkable legislative foresight that a bill and a regulatory framework was placed into existence by Chapter 40 of SLA 1955. Even before there was the discovery of any appreciable amount of oil in the state of Alaska. And I think what that showed is that Alaska was ready, had anticipated what might happen, and when there was the discovery that led to statehood at Swanson River a few years later, a regulatory framework was already in place. Original members of the commission, and it was the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, just as it's named today, those original members were denominated by the legislature to be the governor of Alaska, the territorial commissioner of mines, and the territorial highway engineer. Over the years, the makeup has evolved. There have always been three members, and maybe I could help you a little bit. I'm reluctant to do this because it indicates my age. So if I say something, it doesn't mean I'm knowledgeable or smart. It just means I'm getting older. But I have known virtually every commissioner since statehood. I have followed the commission. I have known their work, their qualifications. And I could say that generally speaking, over the years, virtually all of the commissioners had, well, they would fit the requirements of this bill. There have been perhaps a few that were not up to that level of what I see in the bill as having some minimal understanding of the industry. But generally speaking, that's been the case in Alaska. I believe that this is a step in the right direction, and we have sent in a letter indicating that the commission could support this and would support it. I think this language has the advantage of retaining for the governor and the legislature in the future a lot of flexibility about who to support, but it would indicate that there should be some minimal understanding of the industry. Now, my understanding of the industry goes back 40 years. I was trained as a geologist. I worked with Skelly Oil Company. I was up here initially. I was in the AG's office advising this commission. I advised Department of Natural Resources when we had the big 1969 oil and gas lease sale. I participated in the hearings on the flaring in Cook Inlet. I have written nationally for over 25 years on oil and gas publications, and I can tell you that virtually every other day in this job, I'm still sent back to the books or sitting down with the engineers to understand something. There is an expectation, I think, on the part of the industry that a commission like this will have a basic familiarity. There's a whole vocabulary. It's not just the technical aspects of it, but it's how the industry behaves. There's a whole framework of legal regulation. There are hundreds and hundreds of commission orders that have been entered over the years that need to be understood and factored in. And so I would view this as a step in the right direction by bringing up Alaska in the step with what the practice that we see in other states. Now, I am happy to report to you that having recently completed a year as the national vice chairman of the Interstate Oil and Gas Commission, Alaska's regulatory structure and the oversight over the oil and gas industry is very much respected, not just throughout the United States, but we have delegations coming in from Norway, from the Soviet Union, wanting to know how we regulate the industry. Likewise, the industry, when it moves into a new area, they expect to see a regulatory structure and regulators that understand their industry. Again, I'd use myself as an example, but the understanding of the industry doesn't necessarily mean that you are in any way in the pocket of or have the mindset of the industry. I have, in my practice, represented Alaska's native corporations in transactions where the industry was on the other side of the table. I've done that repeatedly, and in a confidential setting, I'd be happy to give you the names of those. I have represented individual homesteaders in the Nanilchik area in negotiations with Marathon Oil, as an example. And I believe they were very pleased with the representation they got. Likewise, in the Mat Valley, I've represented individual Alaskans. So I think what the way I'm reading this is not that you shall have gained your experience in the industry. Indeed, it might just be the reverse, but that you at least have enough of an understanding to be able to discharge your responsibilities and keep an eye on that industry. That's our main job here. And I think having come into it, I've put a lot of thought into this and gone around and around on what I might recommend. And at first, holding hearings, presiding over sometimes contested matters is a part of our work, and I thought the credentials of an attorney might be useful, given my background in the Attorney General's office years ago and in private practice. But I've evolved to the standpoint where I think that we are best to leave it that we would have an Alaskan that would represent the public, if you will, or the third position, but I don't think it's too much to ask that that person have an understanding, a basic understanding, I'll use the word basic, fundamental, of the industry. And I think, again, to underscore the fact that often that understanding is not necessarily derived with having worked in the industry, it's having been on the other side of the table from the industry. So I would conclude, I think, by saying that I believe we will do a service, and the legislature will, to future commissioners by having this expectation clearly out there so that when they settle into the job, they will not be adrift, because this can be a very confusing position if you don't have a very good understanding of the industry. And you can go two ways with it. You could simply coast along. There's a fine professional staff here, but you won't really know the questions to ask. Or conversely, you might be overly suspicious of the industry because you, again, don't have the ability to discern a lot of the nuances of operation and what occurs. We will be in step with most of the other states, certainly the producing states, by having a professional commission, and I think we'll be well served by it. And so I thank you again on my behalf and on behalf of Commissioner Seamount and Forrester. And we will certainly answer any questions you have, including elaborating on what we do here, if that's beneficial to you. But I know your time is limited, and so we want to spend it on whatever questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Norman. Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Norman, I'm concerned about the three words at the end of this, where it's in the state, and I'm thinking that that might more severely restrict the number of applicants than we need. I can understand the wanting a person with fundamental understanding of oil and gas industry, but I'm concerned that where we require that knowledge to be from within the state, that it might constrain the appointees. And
yes, I understand your question exactly. I think it's very perceptive and a good reading of this. And I think a period after industry would work here, because if you go back to Section 1 of the bill, the reading there is still that the governor shall give preference, and then presumably the legislature also in your confirmation process will give preference to a person who demonstrates experience in oil and gas operations in the state. So the preference is there. Now, you could reach out and select a third member from outside the state, and in fact, that has been done in the past, and the persons selected have generally performed pretty well. But I think my observation would be also, though, that we use the phrase that Alaska is unique, and we really are. My thought would be, if someone asked my opinion about this, is that it is desirable to have somebody that's lived here. This is your home. Your allegiance is to Alaskans. You understand the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. There's 44 million acres out there that we regulate. You understand the huge body of federal lands that we regulate. You understand some of the concerns of our fishing industry, things like that, that unless you've spent time on the ground here, you can learn that, certainly. But a period will work after the word industry, because you still have the preference expressed in Section 1, and that, I think, would allow the flexibility to appoint someone that hasn't been actually from in the state, but still you'd give preference or a nod to preference for persons who, all things being equal, have experience in the state versus those who don't. I hope that answered your question.
Thoroughly. Mr. Norman, Representative Gatto has a question for you.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gatto.
I did have a question, and it was initially, and I'm going to repeat it, what exactly is it that the commission does? And you gave us a fairly long dissertation and then said, if you'd like to know what we do, and actually that was the only question. What is it that the commission does? Because I have a degree in engineering. I don't know, I have any oil field experience. I've drilled water wells. Have 3 years, now in my fourth year, on the Resources Committee. Would I be a good candidate for the commission? I have no way of knowing.
Mr. Norman,
so what is it that the commission, what questions do they get and what are their answers?
May I say before you answer, Mr. Norman, that Representative Gatto, I would be delighted to confirm you. You came before this committee. Mr. Norman, I'll let you respond, please.
Yes, thank you. What this commission does in the state of Alaska is similar to what other commissions in the state of Oklahoma, in the state of Texas, Kansas, Colorado do. The work of commissions such as this was an outgrowth of the 1930s when the industry was virtually unregulated. And there was a period of time there when spacing requirements were almost non-existent. The rule of capture applied. The faster you could poke straws in the ground and suck the oil out, the faster you could reduce it to possession. And consequently, the governors of a number of states came together and formed the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, adopted a model act. That model act then was brought north by a young geologist and was adopted by the Alaska Territorial Legislature in 1955. We exist to oversee the orderly development of hydrocarbon resources in the state of Alaska. Our work is primarily underground, but we try to ensure that best engineering practices and best geologic science is applied, that well spacing is not so close, that the production does not occur in a way that it dissipates energy and then leaves oil in the ground unrecoverable, much the way that if you popped off a carbonated beverage, it'll eventually go flat.
Mr. Norman?
And so we regulate the injection of substances into the ground. We have the ability to do what's called forced pooling or forced unitization, where companies are not able to come together on their own and agree. If they're in a dispute, then we convene a hearing. We take expert testimony from all. We make a detailed record similar to what would occur in the Superior Court. And we generally oversee what is done. Our work is virtually cradle to grave. Every time someone wants to make a hole in the ground in Alaska in search of or for the production of oil and gas, they must first come to this commission, obtain a permit, and we pick it up, and I think of it as an air traffic controller would be.
Mr.
It comes on our screen, and then we do not turn loose of it until the point at which perhaps many years later, it could be 20, 30 years later, or it could be very quickly, that well is properly plugged and abandoned.
Mr. Norman?
By that we mean put to bed in a way that it does not constitute any threat to safety or the environment or anything else. And Representative Gatto, in your district, as you probably may well recall, there were some wells, there were four of them, as I recall, about 2 years ago recently, as a result of some drilling in that area. The company went bankrupt and the wells were abandoned, known as orphaned wells. We're the agency of last resort that steps in, and we took charge and were able to properly plug and abandon those wells.
Mr. Norman, we appreciate that. We've got a highlight sheet in here, what the commission has done. It appears that you modify pool rules, you extend pilot projects, you modify enhanced oil recovery, you oversee and approve underground storage of hydrocarbons, you address modifying, approving, or denying disposable injection operations, and you try to reduce paperwork for routine operations.
Yes.
Just with a yes or no, is that pretty accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Norman? We know your time is valuable also, sir. Any other questions for Mr. Norman? Mr. Norman, it has been a delight to have you in the Resource Committee, and you have proven your great worth to the state of Alaska, and we all thank you.
And we thank you very much for allowing us to participate.
Thank you, sir. At the risk of offending any members, I'm not going to ask if there are any more questions for Mr. Norman. We do have a question of whether we want to offer an amendment. Does anybody have any further questions for the sponsor, Representative Coring? All right. And is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify on House Bill 300? All right, seeing none, public testimony is closed. There is a question of whether we want to introduce an amendment to Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move that we strike on page 2, line 26 at the end, starting with N through line 27, state, so that it would read oil and gas industry, period.
I'll object. Just
okay.
Never mind.
May I ask the bill sponsor, Representative Coring, does that change the intent of HB 300?
It takes away the fact that it be more specific to in terms of requiring state experience. I've heard both arguments, and they both sound compelling. So, frankly, I'm neutral on the issue.
Okay.
So, whatever the will of the committee is, fine.
Is there any other discussion, Representative Gatto?
Thank you. The original version of the bill, which I think a version, mm-hmm. asked for that member shall be an attorney, be experienced in business management, experience and dealt with business management. I think three times. The current version of the bill, and that was the only change in the bill, eliminates all of that and says, yep, we don't want any of that.
Yep.
What we want instead is something exactly the opposite.
Yes.
So I'm curious to how we got from A to F, which is a reversal.
All right. Mr. Representative Donald, excuse me, through the chair. The original bill that I actually drafted almost verbatim myself was were just my initial thoughts without really having done an extensive process in terms of consulting with a lot of folks. And my initial reaction was much like yours. Maybe the background ought to be a little more specific. It ought to include a financial background or a business background. We ought to specify a degree, et cetera. But then upon further reflection and after having talked to folks, including those at the Oil and Gas Association, we felt it would be more prudent to delete those portions and just go with some more generic language that may reference strictly to the oil and gas industry.
So this started out in oil and gas, and you're the chair.
Right.
You took the recommendations of people involved in
the
operation.
Absolutely.
And actually changed your whole bill. Congratulations. It's rare to see somebody actually turn their own bill around like
okay.
that.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to, through the chair, I just wanted to make sure it was a well thought through bill, and that before we actually attempted to advance this initially through oil and gas, that it was a bill with the right language that was amenable to most interests. And we worked with the administration as well on this too, and they thought that was a good change also, as opposed to narrowing it down too much and boxing them in into limiting the potential pool of applicants for a future position.
Thank you, Representative Coring. Any other questions on the amendment? Any more discussion on the amendment? Do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Okay. Did you want to make a remark?
Yes.
Representative Seaton, please.
I just wanted to say that I do think that what we're saying by having it here is that the person's training or experience has to have been in Alaska, and I don't think that that's really the intent. I think that if someone has experience in training in the oil and gas industry, they would be able to function well in this position, and making that very much narrows beyond even what a petroleum geologist requirement is, and so that's why I'm making the motion. Thank
okay.
you.
Excellent point. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Libio?
Yes.
Representative Kapsner absent? Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Elkin?
No.
Representative Olson?
Absent.
Representative Samuels?
No.
Representative Brammer?
No.
That's three yeses and four noes.
So the amendment fails. We're back to the original bill. Are there any other amendments to HB 300? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move HB 300.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the House Resource Committee move House Bill 300 with the individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Zero. Objection. Seeing none, HB 300 moves from Representative Elkins?
I object.
You do object? Okay. Representative Elkins?
You know, well, bottom line, I think there are a lot of people out in this state that are qualified. You know, he doesn't live in this state, but this bill would keep a Bill Gates type person from sitting on the board, and I just can't support it.
Chair Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it tightens up. I mean, it's a political appointed position, and I agree with the sponsor. It tightens up a little bit. And I think Mr. Norman hit it on the head. At least you should understand the terminology. I mean, I think that all of us members, just from sitting here for the last 3 years, would probably now qualify. But should I have qualified before? I knew nothing about oil and gas other than you put gas on an airplane wing. That's all I knew. So you should have somebody that at least understands the terminology, or, as Mr. Norman said, how ANCSA works or how lease unit works, or even if you understood just the tax, at least you bring something to the table. Because you have this huge staff, you get paid a whole lot of money. You should bring something to the table on day one. You don't need to be an expert, but so that's.
I concur. Is there other conversation for someone to do?
I think my feelings is that it pretty much eviscerates the public member.
What does eviscerate mean?
Pardon me?
What does eviscerate mean?
What does eviscerate mean? It kind of destroys it.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't. I'm sorry. I don't understand. Sorry.
Basically, I think in this state we've got this concept of on various commissions, including the Oil and Gas Commission, we're going to have public membership, people who are not connected in one way or the other with the industry.
Okay.
And basically, I see this as pretty much dissolving that public member requirement.
Okay. All right. Chair Simmons?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. This commission, as well as probably the Board of Fish and the Board of Game, the rest of the boards just pale in comparison. The Board of Real Estate Appraisers, if you had a public member of the Board of Real Estate Appraisers, they're not dealing with tens of billions of dollars. So I agree that the public should have their seat on this, but to ask that they at least understand the terminology, I don't think is asking too much. Board of Game, Board of Fish, the same thing. If somebody has never held a fishing license, never been hunting, never been outdoors, isn't from Alaska, and all of a sudden you put them on the Board of Fish within Alaska and ask them to deal with it, if they don't understand just nothing whatsoever, it's asking a lot. And what these people do, and I can be much shorter than Mr. Norman was, is they maximize hydrocarbon recovery. They will. This commission determines whether or not we can take off 2.7 B a day at Point Thompson, and how much oil are we going to leave behind. And if we're going to leave too much oil behind, and you maximize the amount of money coming out of the ground for the state of Alaska for the long term. I understand the public needs to have their member there, but I think it's not asking too much to set a very minimal standard. I agreed with the changes the sponsor made. An attorney doesn't necessarily know anything about oil and gas. While the public member could have been a roughneck up on the slope, and he has no ties to industry. There's no problem with being in the industry's pocket there. But at least he would understand how things work. He's gotten his hands dirty. Or you have an oil and gas, even a tax lawyer that does oil and gas work, as opposed to, you know, when Representative Corrine changed it. I could pick a lawyer out of Anchorage that does civil work and knows nothing, knows far less than those of us sitting here right now.
Okay.
So, thank you. I support the bill.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had some reservations about this, and I was concerned, and I don't know because I was late, you may have already given an explanation as to what you felt was broken and needed to be fixed. Mm-hmm. I believe that the way the bill is written presently, that it's still going to be up to the governor to appoint the person and up to us to confirm them. As it's written right now, you could, the governor could appoint Richard Feinberg to this commission, and if the legislature confirmed it, we could have Richard Feinberg on the AOGCC. So I'm not going to object to this bill as written. I'm still not certain what the problem was, but I don't think this is going to make a fundamental change in the way things are.
Thank you.
Any other final comments? Let me just tell the committee what we're going to do. We have three bills up today, the one by Rep. Coring. We have a resolution, Representative Elkin, and one from Representative Ledoux. And I've made arrangements for Northern Dynasty to make at least a 15-minute presentation for us at 2:45. So we have about 55 minutes to conduct our business. So with that, if everybody would just be mindful of the clock. Representative Gatto.
Thanks. Briefly, I like the A version, and I don't object to the F version. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish they were combined. Mm-hmm. But it does allow the governor to combine them in his own mind, satisfy the bill by picking someone in the industry and still picking someone who's got business management.
Thank you. Representative. Any other remarks? All right. Do you maintain the objection?
Yes. No. No, I don't.
Okay. We draw the.
Count.
Huh?
I can count.
With that, seeing no objection, HB 300 moves from committee. And with that, Representative Elkin will be delighted to take up HGR 14. But I will assure you, Representative Ledoux, we will have ample time to address your issue.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for consideration and support of the legislation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Coring. It is a pleasure to have you in our committee. We feel like you're a kissing cousin to resources, so we're happy to have you, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't let Jim Van Horn carry this bill today, so.
Good morning, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Van Horn. For the record, I'm a staff of Representative Jim Elkins. Before you today is House Joint Resolution 14. Basically, it is a just to pass, urge the United States Congress to pass legislation to convey land, federal land, to the University of Alaska. It voices support for United States Senate Bill 293, the Federal University Land Bill, which was introduced by Senator Lisa Murkowski. That legislation provides a grant from the federal government of 250,000 acres of up to an additional 250,000 acres match from the state. As the largest landholder in Alaska, it is important that the federal government provide support to the University of Alaska. The university needs a more dependable revenue stream, and this legislation will make the University of Alaska system more stable and similar to other land-grant institutions across the nation. Eventually, they'll be able to become financially independent from yearly funding allocations from the legislature. In conjunction with House Bill 130, which was passed last session, this land grant package will give the University of Alaska as much as 760,000 acres and will make them the envy of universities around the globe. HGR 14 will inform the members of Congress how important United States Senate Bill 293 is to Alaskans, because producing a long-term revenue stream for the university is imperative and in the best interest of all Alaskans. Also in your packet, Mr. Chairman, there is a very informative legislative research report, and part of that report is an excellent piece done by Professor Cole at the university. It's entitled A Land-Grant College Without the Land. Even though it was done in November of 1993, it speaks well of the current land situation for the university. I should bring a note to the to the committee on page 7 of that report by Professor Cole. Down at the bottom says lack of land income. The lack of land was clearly seen as in the university's balance sheet. During the University of Alaska's first three decades, from 1917 to 1946, the total revenue to its permanent fund from land sales, rentals, and leases was $227.50. This was because the land that was originally conveyed to them way back in 1915 was not completed due to lack of adequate surveys in Alaska. Again, the federal agencies tasked with that were very slow in doing their surveys, so it was never completed. And I'm open for any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Van Horn. First of all, I just want to thank you and the sponsor for your presentation. I thought one of the most valuable pieces of work that this committee oversaw last year was the university lands bill and that lands transfer. And I'm a fan of this for two reasons. One is the federal government owes us this land, and secondly, there is no state-related entity better than the university. It's proven they can get land from the public into the hands of private citizens, let alone the good that it does for the university's treasury. So I thank you and the sponsor for bringing this forward. With that, I'll ask if there are any members that have questions for the sponsor, and then we'll Joe Beadle is here, and then Dick Miles from Land Mining and Water is available by telephone to answer any questions for the members. Any questions for the sponsor? I think we covered this last year very, very well, so I just thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Stamos?
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question on page 2 on the first further resolved. A provision to provide that land grants do not interfere with public assets or along fishing streams, and so on and so on. How much land do you eliminate by asking Congress to do that? What exactly are you looking for? And is that a weapon that the Congress is going to use now to say, no, we're going to stop doing this?
Through the chair, to you, Representative Samuels. What line are you on, sir?
Line 11.
Line 11.
Further resolve.
Further resolve is that was inserted by the Education Committee, our first hearing on this legislation. The actual bill, Senate Bill 293, is very specific as to some of the sideboards as far as transferring the land. But the committee felt that this additional sideboard or restriction was notable, and it was put in there. We had no objection to that. I don't know. I can't answer as far as how much land is going to be prohibited from being transferred. The only thing is that the committee felt it was imperative that traditional access to some of these properties, these lands, should be maintained for recreation and fishing and so forth, and as far as some subsistence fishing. So this is why it was put in there.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, Chairman, I might be mistaken, but didn't we pass a bill last year that required that on state lands? Didn't the House move a bill last year that said that? Muscara had a bill that required state lands to allow access to.
I don't recollect. Do you?
Representative Guerra had a bill which I believe allowed the state to go in and buy land near for public access. The fear that I've got with the paragraph, the way I read it, and I'll ask Mr. Beadle when he comes up here, a provision to provide that land grants do not interfere with public access to or along fishing streams. That would be something. We want the land, whether or not there's public access or not, and then we're going to tell the university not to mess with it. You don't want the feds to come in here and say, well, I mean, of all the streams in Alaska, I mean, try to find enough land and stay 50 feet from every stream and every river in Alaska and every hunting, dog mushing, motorized vehicle mining, recreational trail, and try to find 250,000 acres that don't have a stream running through them. How much land are you going to get Congress to go, we simply can't do this, it's impossible, and that's what Alaska wanted? And that would be my fear. But I'd defer to Mr. Beadle to see if I'm reading too much into this paragraph.
Any more questions for the bill sponsor? Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joe, do you want to come up and help us with this and anything else in the resolution that might be a concern to you? And then we'll pose the same question, Dick Miles, in just a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Beadle. I'm the Vice President for Finance at the University of Alaska System Office. I'd like to start by thanking this body last year for the tremendous work you did in helping the university get its state land grant for 250,000 acres. We have not yet received any of that land, but we're optimistic that we're going through the protocols to receive that land in due order. Apologize to the bill sponsor that we were not at the Special Committee on Education to represent our appreciation for the legislature supporting a resolution for passage of federal legislation to gain these additional 500,000 acres. Speaking on behalf of the Board of Regents and the President, we thank you for supporting this resolution, and we would ask that you continue to do so. I'd be happy to make comments regarding the evolution of that proposed Senate Bill 293 and simply state that we are waiting for the right opportunity and alignment working with our good congressional representatives to support that effort, and be happy to answer any detailed questions you might have.
I think the question would be Rep. Samuel's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The same question on page 2, line 11, that entire paragraph. It seems like you muddy the waters so much that to try to find the land that you'd want to convey, you know, I'd rather try to put the screws to the university to say, we gave you this land, but now you can't touch this public access and you have to take care of the streams, rather than tell the feds, we don't want that, we'll take land somewhere else. And as I said, to find this much land without a stream through it is probably difficult.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, in addition to looking forward to the answer of the director of the Lands Division, the university would believe that this is a limiting issue, and to limit a federal transfer to the state, the university agrees with your sentiments, and in fact, we would find it redundant in many cases with the efforts that that the state legislature imposes and asks the university to deal with in a public policy manner. There are some mentions of in perpetuity limitations to the land that we would not even encourage the state to mandate, especially coming from a federal legislation. So we agree and would speak to remove or recommend that section be removed. It probably can be addressed in the future as the land is received.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there other questions for Mr. Beadle? Seeing none, we thank you. It's always an honor to have you here. Joe, you do. You're a good man. You do a lot of good things for the university and the state. With that, Dick, are you with us online?
I'm muted, though, here. Hello?
Hi, Mr. Miles.
I'm a representative?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I thought I was muted still. Yeah, this is Dick Miles at the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And I am mainly here to answer questions, but since there is one question, I can go ahead and answer that.
Please.
When we acquire land from the federal government, we prefer it be unencumbered. I mean, that's the state's general philosophy. And then if the legislature wants to impose on that land some sort of protection for public access, that's usually better done by the legislature instead of something done by Congress. If Congress did deal with such language, I think we'd advocate that they just allow for certain easements to be reserved to ensure public access, but you wouldn't want to have some provision where Congress could actually reject parcels because they want to protect public access. That would not be a good thing to have in the federal legislation.
All right. Thanks, Dick. Representative Elkins has a question for you.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, I just think that what we're really trying to say here, and it maybe it's not delivered properly, but we just want some sort of covenant in there that guarantees access to this land after transferred to the University of Alaska, and I'm not sure the state, once it was transferred, would have the authority to go in and require access without a covenant in the transfer.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Malias? Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Yes, I was wondering, is Representative Elkins brought up a point there, land that's transferred from the federal government to the University of Alaska, can the legislature put in provisions for land that we're not transferring but that is transferred to the university to ensure public access?
Representative, was that a question for me?
Yes.
Smiley is here.
Yes, it was, Dick.
Okay, through the chair. Actually, well, I think I need to defer to Joe Beadle on that question, because certainly on land managed by DNR, the legislature can put conditions on how we manage the land. I believe they probably can do that with the university, unless the grant is real specific and has limitations in there. But I think Joe might be better able to address that.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Joe's right here. Go ahead, please, Mr. Beadle.
Mr. Chairman, we are subject to the Constitution and the laws of the state, and access, especially on water bodies and especially those that are in natural streams and whatnot, there are absolute current laws that we would be subject to without further enactment by specific legislation. And then furthermore, you can act upon in the future additional constraints should you choose to impose them upon the university.
Representative Elkins.
A little bit tongue-in-cheek, Joe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would we be required to buy that access, though? Or would it just be granted to us?
Through the chair, if that was a question, Representative Elkins, it depends. If it's an absolute protected right, then we could not charge for it. If it was an additional right that was imposed upon or desired upon the university, we could charge for special easements that were not public domain mandates, such as power lines and that sort of thing.
Thank you. Chair Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The legislature could do as it sees fit after the land is transferred. I mean, the legislature could do as it sees fit after the land is transferred. We can tell you, you can't charge, you must do this, you must do that. That's what we do. Not much to the chagrin of most people in this room, but so I will be offering an amendment at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any more questions for Mr. Beadle, for Mr. Milas? Anybody have any more questions? Mm-hmm. Dick, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on the resolution? All right, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Any amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I would move amendment number 1 to delete lines 11 through 14 on page 2.
Objection?
Conceptual amendments, right?
I'm sorry?
I view that as a conceptual amendment.
Conceptual amendment. Anybody object to conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. Any other amendments to be offered to this? Any discussion? I'd entertain a motion to move HJR 14.
I'd so move.
Any objection? Seeing none, HJR 14 moves from the Resources Committee. Thank you very much. And now, we will take up the weed bill.
Forget me not.
Right?
As opposed
the good
to the
weed
water bill.
Yeah, right. It's a good thing the title's not that broad, huh? Representative Ledoux, Suzanne Hancock, I have, yes, will be presenting this on your behalf.
It's a weed.
We can tell what's going to be.
Good afternoon, Ms. Hancock. It's nice to have you in front of the Resource Committee. We look forward to your presentation. Thanks, Joe.
For the record, I'm Suzanne Hancock, staff representative Gabrielle Ledoux.
Representative thanks the chair and the committee for hearing this bill, which is an act banning the importation, transfer, and cultivation of orange hawkweed and purple loosestrife. Representative Ledoux's intention with filing HB 324 was to respond to concerns from her constituents. Scientists as well as gardeners are concerned about new strains of noxious weeds that are taking hold in Alaska. These invasive plants crowd out our native plants and cultivated plants and are devastating to the environment and people's gardens. Orange hawkweed and purple loosestrife were chosen because they have been the ones in the spotlight. Purple loosestrife is a threat to wetlands and waterfowl. In my community of Kodiak, groups have been pulling up, bagging, and disposing of orange hawkweed. The state agency that has oversight in this area is the Department of Natural Resources. The language in this bill has the commissioner adopting regulations providing for the disposal of orange hawkweed and purple loosestrife and plant parts to prevent further propagation of the species in the state. Statute currently lists many noxious weeds, but has not kept up with new species, including these two. This bill only applies to those who knowingly plant or cultivate an orange hawkweed or purple loosestrife plant. This offense is a Class A misdemeanor, but the intent is not to have weed police, but to educate the public about the menace these and other invasive species present to our environment, agricultural crops, streams, and gardens. As a legislator, Representative Ledoux sponsors the bill because she considers it good public policy. There will be members of the scientific community, gardeners, and others testifying in their areas of expertise.
Thank you. Questions for the sponsor? Okay. Don't mind if I do then. Go ahead, Representative Crawford.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My wife has become, she's gone through the Master Gardener class, and there's a large list of ornamental plants and flowers that have been sold throughout the state as things for your garden. And I remember that these were both listed as some of the worst offenders. But, I mean, there's also a large list of other what in some people's gardens are beautiful flowers, and in our wilds appear a noxious weed. So I was just wondering why we stopped it at these two species.
I believe from what we've learned studying these weeds and the problem in the state is that eventually the Department of Natural Resources will be updating their lists. This was kind of a rapid response to two weeds that are pernicious and causing problems. Through the chair, Representative Crawford, you're from the South, you know kudzu, am I pronouncing it correctly? Apparently they say in Georgia you have to keep your windows closed at night or it'll be growing in your living room the next day. And these weeds show the tendencies of acting almost in the same way. Purple loosestrife is now choking Chester Creek in Anchorage, and orange hawkweed is especially pernicious in Kodiak, and not just in Alaska. It's presenting itself as a problem in Yellowstone Park. So I think the reason we put forward this legislation is not that we don't think that DNR is doing their job, it's just that they haven't been able to keep up. And these two are, at least from what Representative Ledoux has been told, sort of the poster children of bad weeds.
Okay. Representative Gatto?
Thank you. Dandelions are imported, and vetch is crawling all over Mad Valley and my guess everywhere. It's not possible to control those at this point. Do you think it's possible to control the two species you mentioned, eliminate them, or hold them back for 5 more years and then watch them take off?
Well, I think that prevention is part of the goal here. And mostly a lot of it is educating people because, as you say, I know for myself personally in Kodiak, I'm not much of a gardener, but every so often one of the neighbors' daisies would show up in my yard or some columbine, and one day there was orange hawkweed, and I thought, oh, and this is pretty, this is nice, and I had no idea. So I think a lot of what both DNR and the several groups that are going to be speaking and many other people in the state are trying to do is just to educate people about what the problem is. And I know, like I say, in our community, we've actually had groups of people go out and pull it up and bag it and dispose of it. So we're looking at it from both angles.
I guess I go back to the question, you think you can stop it?
I mean, I guess that's where they have the expression growing like weeds. I mean, you've seen weeds growing up in cement in cities. It is really difficult. But we want to get ahead of it because many states are spending not only millions of dollars to eradicate these weeds, but also spending millions of dollars to replant indigenous plants that are no longer there. We could be years from now trying to seed places and grow the state flower because they've been choked out by weeds.
Thank you. I've got a couple questions. On page 2, line 4, the penalty phase there, the penalty in AS 0305090, what's the penalty?
Class A misdemeanor.
Class A misdemeanor. Okay, thanks. And a question either for yourself or maybe the sponsor. On page 1, line 7, I think you may not import. Would knowingly be an appropriate caveat there? Knowingly import? Is there any chance that this the seeds get are on your cuff and you walk through a yard and
absolutely.
Whatnot? 'Cause knowingly is included somewhere. Oh, on number 3 on line 13 is knowingly plant or cultivate. So is importation something you knowingly do? Is it possible you can do it by accident?
I'm sure it is possible. I think some of the new kind of seeds that people get to kind of be ground cover that include a variety of different plants, it would be possible. And but a person would not know.
Does it put a standard on there that you don't want to have? I don't. Would you?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. I was talking to.
Oh, I'm sorry. On page 1, line 7, right on number 1, if you put knowingly import, I mean, you don't want to.
I don't have any problems.
I mean, as a legal definition, does that put a standard on there that's higher? You don't want to let somebody off the hook. But.
I mean, the idea is we don't want to be the weed Gestapo. I mean, so.
Yes.
But I almost think that in the definition of any criminal law, it has to be a knowingly, or you're not doing anything criminal.
Okay, I'll defer.
So. But I don't do criminal law, so.
And the last question I've got is on page 1, line 10, at the end of the sentence, and then on to line 11, to another person. No, and I guess number 3 covers my question, so that's fine.
I think knowingly is the key word to the chair.
So with that, it's all yours again.
Great. Thank you very much. Any more questions for the sponsor? All right, well, thank you very much. Again, I'm mindful of the clock and hope to move this bill because I don't think it's going to be difficult to do today, but we do have people from Kenai, Kodiak, Anchorage. Kate Troll is here. Kate, you want to testify? Please do. Come on up.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Troll. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Conservation Alliance, which represents about 40 conservation groups and businesses, total combined membership of about 38,000. So we are the opportunity for the conservation community to try and speak on state issues with one voice. And I was tempted to jump in on the last discussion since it was the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Maybe there should be a conservation seat, but anyway. I'm here to address House Bill 324 and we very much view this as a good start for Alaska, that as the sponsor has noted, orange hawkweed, you know, has the potential to degrade many Alaska ecosystems, particularly the riparian and the wildlife areas. It's currently recognized as an invasive weed in south central and southeast. Purple loosestrife is known as a plant that aggressively outcompetes native wetland plants and is responsible for degradation of a considerable amount of wetland habitat in the U.S., and we now have it in Anchorage. I think the committee should be aware that there are other species of grave concern to us in Alaska. Then we have the Norway rat, Atlantic salmon, northern pike, even though it's natural, is now moving beyond its native range. We've got European green crab.
Can you just speak to
I will do. I'm
this
just,
bill, please?
I am. I'm just want that in the context of this being a good start.
Okay.
We support that.
Yes, ma'am.
And that certainly prevention is a good step forward in that it tends to save millions of dollars down the line. We don't have any figure for, you know, how much we would save by being proactive on hawkweed and loosestrife, but there's many case studies that show that being proactive can save millions and billions of dollars, the zebra mussel being one. While we look at this as an important first step, I do want to emphasize it's important not to solve one problem by creating another, and that's where people get into the question about the use of pesticides. And that's a complex issue, and I think it needs to be sort of dealt with on a case-by-case situation. And I'm not an expert on that, and so I would just ask that the committee might consider an amendment which will help address this matter down the line. And in that context, I would suggest looking at adding some language under Section 1B where it would state, in developing these regulations, emphasis should be placed on using the most strategic and least toxic method of eradication. It kind of just sets that concept in place, which, since this is the first piece of legislation dealing with it, it would seem appropriate. It doesn't eliminate the use of pesticides, but it just talks about it in a proper context. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much
for the opportunity.
Yes, ma'am. Are there questions for Ms. Troll? All right, seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anybody else here in the room that would like to testify on this issue? All right, if not, then we will go offline. If we can start first in Kodiak, we have Aaron Whipple and then Blythe Brown. And again, we'll not put a limit on your testimony, but I'll remind you the committee has got an objective to meet here in the next 25 minutes, so please make your comments specific and germane to the House bill. Aaron Whipple, please.
Yes, my name is Aaron Whipple, and I'm a resident of Kodiak, and I work in the environmental field for a native corporation. And I just want to state that I strongly support this bill. I think that this is a huge step forward as far as prevention of the importation, the voluntary importation of noxious and invasive species. I have seen firsthand in working with the orange hawkweed infestation on Camp Island what this small, appearingly unassuming plant can do in a matter of years. The plant has an average height of 10 inches and can outcompete 6-foot pushkey until it becomes the only species in an acre-plus field. And it serves no purpose whatsoever for our bird and animal species. It doesn't provide feed, it doesn't provide shelter, and therefore it's out competing plants that do provide those resources to our wildlife. And I know that the lady who just testified said she didn't have a dollar figure to put on this, and of course no one has one at this point for Alaska, but I can quote from a recent weed management plan that the state of Montana put together, that they have 8.2 million acres in Montana currently infested with noxious weeds, and it's calculated that approximately 47 million is needed to implement a balanced weed management program that slows weed spread and reduces current infestations by 5% a year. When you multiply the acreage that the state of Alaska has, contrary to Montana, we're talking billions of dollars if we don't take these first steps now to fight weeds in the future.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Whipple. Are there any questions for Aaron Whipple? Thank you very much for your testimony. Blythe Brown, are you there?
Yes, I am. My name is Blythe Brown. I'm the Noxious and Invasive Plants Coordinator for the Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District.
Mm-hmm.
I also volunteer for the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. In July of 2002, the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge manager asked me about a little orange flower she had seen on Camp Island in Karluk Lake. The Karluk Lake area is one of Kodiak's most productive salmon and brown bear habitats, and that little orange flower was orange hawkweed. Kodiak has done very well with voluntary weed control. They've come a long way in the last 3 years since the orange hawkweed control project was started on Camp Island. The problem was pointed out, and Kodiak has freely shared information, started eradication of some infestation, stopped sharing certain plants between gardeners, and quit planting troublemakers in public gardens. Unfortunately, the problem is larger than Kodiak. Sometimes it takes more than a small community volunteer effort to fix a problem. This bill is just a start, as many people have already pointed out. It calls attention to two very aggressive and showy plants that have invaded valuable habitats in our state. It also highlights a major method of spread for these and other invasive plants, people. Many other species need to be covered, too. What about Japanese knotweed or spotted knapweed? Rather than just add species to this bill, my personal feeling is that we need to tie it to a species list that can be changed without having to change a whole law or regulation. This is a good start, but we have lots of work ahead of us. As I understand it, current weed laws in the state are actually agricultural feed laws. Our agricultural areas are jeopardized by invasive plants, but so too are our wildlands and valuable fish, wildlife, and subsistence habitats. The agricultural community is taking responsibility for their weeds, but now the rest of Alaska needs to realize that they too are part of the problem and can be part of the solution. Orange hawkweed and purple loosestrife do invade undisturbed habitats. They are not just common garden weeds. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Ms. Brown? All right, seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Let's go to Varsha Mathrani in Anchorage with ACAT. Can you state your name and who you're with for the record, please, and try and keep your remarks as short as possible? Okay, very good.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Varsha?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Varsha. Yes, please. Will you state your name for the record and who you're with? It says ACAT.
Sure. It's Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and my name is Varsha Mathrani.
Mm-hmm.
ACAT's a state nonprofit environmental health and justice organization, and we conduct research and provide educational programs, technical assistance, and training. Alaska Community Action on Toxics approves of HB 324 as a measure to prevent invasive species from taking root and disrupting diverse...
Varsha, can I may I interrupt you?
Yep.
We all have your letter in front of you that you're beginning to read from.
Oh, sure.
So we already have that in the remarks. Do you have anything that you'd like to add in addition to your written testimony that we all have right here in our bill packets?
No, just to emphasize prevention and educating the public about... these plants, and to also think of using other methods, least toxic alternatives to herbicides for getting rid of invasive species, and more of an integrative approach of mechanical and biological control. And the details are in my testimony.
Appreciate that. Are there any questions for Varsha? And like I say, ma'am, we all have your letter here in the committee. I was just reviewing it just as you came online.
Okay.
So with that, we thank you very much. And we next like to go to Kenai to Janice Chumley. Sterling. Janice, are you with us?
Yes, I am, and I thank you for your time and for hearing my testimony. I'm sitting here before you today as a private citizen and a master gardener as well, and I know full well the problems that come when plants run amok. Having personally seen areas in Homer go from one small plant in the cemetery of orange hawkweed to the entire cemetery being nothing but orange hawkweed in a matter of 15 years, I have great concern about plants being introduced into the state and changing what we all like to preserve as our wildlands. And so I would appreciate if you would support this bill and perhaps include it as a list that can be grown without having to go through committee action all the time. And I just would like you all to realize how important it is, how one small plant can change a fishery, a wildlife habitat, and this whole state of Alaska. And so thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Are there any questions for Janice? Janice, we thank you for your time, for finding your way to the LIO to be able to testify for us and give us your insight. Thank you very much. Next, we go to the off-net. We have Rachel Petro and Doug Warner with DNR. Rachel and Doug, are you there?
Yes, we are.
Great. Do you have anything you'd like to add to the testimony you've already heard?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Rachel Petro, for the record, a special assistant to Department of Natural Resources. I have with us today Doug Warner of the Division of Agriculture, and he will be speaking to this bill in specifics, and we'd be happy to entertain questions from the committee on the bill and regarding our current authority in this area.
Okay. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I would just say is that we believe this bill may not be necessary. It would seem that we have existing statutory authority to do implement some of the regulations necessary to control it. As this bill moved forward, we began the process of updating regulations to include provisions for the control of weeds. And maybe, as a couple of previous speakers had mentioned, a broader perspective where we can have a mechanism to add weeds to the list and maybe take weeds off if necessary would be a good perspective also. So a bit broader, more comprehensive package allowing the process to introduce weeds we would support also. We did introduce a zero fiscal note on this just because we assumed that our division staffing would remain the same just for the adoption of regulations. However, I don't know how effective we might be in implementing this if it takes a lot of eradication efforts with a zero fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Doug Warner or for Rachel Petro? Seeing none, we thank you very much for weighing in on this issue and helping us develop a legislative policy toward this. Next is Jamie Snyder with the UAF Cooperative Services.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jamie Snyder. I work for the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service out of Anchorage, and my job is invasive plants public education and community outreach, so I teach about these species and these issues. I had simply called in after a phone call with some of the folks at the DNR to provide information, had there been a need for information on the life cycles of these plants, how they're getting in, how to control them, that type of information. I'll just cut this short since you're short on time and just mention that I echo some of the thoughts that have been expressed by Janice Chumley, Blythe Brown, Aaron Whipple, that prevention is extremely cost efficient. It's much cheaper in terms of funding and resources to focus on prevention than treatment and restoration after the fact. So this is a great first step to address these two species of concern while we cross our fingers and hope that state agencies can develop a functional state noxious weed list. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Snyder. Any questions for Ms. Snyder? All right. Seeing none, is there any other testimony? We have anybody else online? With that, public testimony is closed. Committee discussion. Chair Samuels.
Thank you, Chairman. If there's no objection, the word "knowingly" on that on the first one to make it consistent with number three
No, no problems.
And I would move amendment number one, Mr. Chairman, that on page one, line seven, between the number one and the word import, insert the word knowingly so that we do not become the weed police.
Any objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Any other discussion? All right. I'd be delighted if somebody wanted to move HB 324. Representative Ledoux.
Mr. Speaker, I move HB 324 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Let me revel in that for a moment, please. Before.
Yes, sir.
Object?
Are you moving that as amended?
Yes.
Okay. Amended. All right.
I remove my objection.
Okay. Seeing no objections, the Speaker moves HB 324 from the Resource Committee. Thank you very much. The second weed bill. First meth, marijuana, and now the orange and purple stuff. My God, what's left for personal use? And let's just take an at ease just for a moment while somebody gets Northern Dynasty in here for their presentation. And I just want to thank the committee for their help on that. Let's come back online for the Resource Committee. This gives us about 20 minutes to hear from our friends at Northern Dynasty. And I'll leave it to you, sir, to make as long a presentation as you are inclined. And I would think there would be a great benefit left for 10 minutes of questions for you. So I'd encourage you to keep your initial remarks. With that, if you just introduce yourself, your name, and who you're with for the record, please, and you can have at her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bruce Jenkins, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Northern Dynasty Mines, Inc., the American subsidiary of Northern Dynasty Minerals Limited. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak with you about HCR 29 and to express some of our comments and some of our concerns on the proposed resolution. I recognize that your time is at a premium, and there's lots that I could talk about and could take a lot more time than is available, but believe that there will be plenty of opportunity in the due process review of our project to get into public dialogue on the merits of our project and the risks and the benefits, and that now is not the time to do that. I have a written letter that I will table with the committee, which addresses some of the concerns around the resolution and addresses some of the, what I judge to be rather inflammatory comments in some of the testimony presented to this committee. But I'm not going to walk through those today. What I'd like to do is read to you the last paragraph, just a couple of sentences, and then open it up to a question and answer period. So I want to emphasize that Northern Dynasty Mines is against this resolution, and we're concerned that the resolution provides the mechanism for changing the rules at the end of the permitting process by allowing a reclassification of land use that would prohibit mining. This concern has already been validated by some of the testimony presented to this committee, where it was clearly stated that the intention is to use this resolution as a mechanism to stop the Pebble Project. Such a mechanism would create significant uncertainty, and that is a major deterrent to the international investment community and would seriously undermine resource development, opportunities, and investments in the state of Alaska. Those are our key concerns, Mr. Chair. That is our position on this resolution, and I would be pleased to answer questions.
Excellent, Mr. Jenkins. We appreciate that. Questions for Mr. Jenkins? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If folks around here that know me know I'm a part of organized labor. I'm an iron worker. I've made a living building Alaska for the last 31 years. I like it when there are jobs out there that require iron workers and welders and people that are doing things with their hands. I want you to know that I support growth and development of Alaska's natural resources, but I have a lot of trepidation here because this is really in such a sensitive area where millions of salmon are spawned and you know, there's a lot of I don't know, a lot riding on what you're doing here. So I just want to let you know how very much I want you to do this right.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond. Mm-hmm. Representative Crawford, I appreciate your comments and wish to reassure you that our organization is committed to responsible mineral development. It's easier said than done, but it's one of the reasons the board of directors asked me to be the chief operating officer of this company. I have more than 30 years of experience in controversial projects, resource development. I have a master's degree in fisheries ecology, and that by its very nature should be a signal that we take this seriously. I can't think of any other mining company that has an executive chief operating officer who is a fisheries ecologist by training and education and has more than 30 years of experience in applying that. We recognize the importance of ensuring water quality is preserved and that the fisheries resource is preserved. But contrary to some of the messages that you may be hearing, it is possible to have responsible mine development and protect water and fish at the same time. There are horror stories in the mining industry spanning back the last 50 years. I'm not here to argue that it's a perfect industry. No industry has a perfect track record. But the mining industry has modern techniques, modern processes, and a responsible approach to developing mines properly. You have good examples of that in the state of Alaska. And by way of example, because it's premature for me to give you the details on our project, we haven't even defined it yet. We haven't finished our environmental studies and engineering work. We haven't even applied for permits yet. We're expecting due process will be offered us. But in the absence of all that information, a reasonable person would look for other precedents. Where are there case studies where this can be proven? And I would just point to what I characterize as Alaska of the South, which is my home province of British Columbia. The Fraser River system drains the heartland of British Columbia and has the largest salmon populations in Canada, second only to Bristol Bay. We have millions and millions of sockeye, hundreds of thousands of chinook and coho and chum and pink and steelhead trout and sturgeon in the Fraser River. One of our sister companies, Taseko Mines, operates the 70,000-ton-a-day open-pit copper mine at Gibraltar near Williams Lake. It's been operating for 26 years. We bought it only 4 years ago. It is closer to the Fraser River than the proposed pebble mine site would be to the main stem Nushagak-Mulchatna by a large margin. It's within 10 miles of the main stem. And do you know what the net impact of that operating mine has been on the Fraser River salmon over 26 years of operations? Zero. Do you know what the net impact of that operating mine has been on the market price for the wild salmon from the Fraser? Zero. So it's easy to claim impacts from a mine, but precedent and experience doesn't support many of the wild claims. Having said that, we only ask for due process where we can present our science, our engineering, and the case studies in the form of facts before an independent adjudicating body, the state and federal review, and let the facts speak for themselves. And we hope to be held as accountable to standards of honesty and objectivity as will anyone else who comments on our project. And that's not possible before the permitting process.
Thank you. Representative Gatto?
Thank you. CEO, huh? an impressive title. So you would probably have authority. I hear from almost every commercial fisherman who's going to be in the waters that you mentioned saying, terrible idea. That's, I'm relating to their comments, which reflect their fears. They say the most valuable resource in the world, probably, for fishing is that resource right there. And they don't want to see it jeopardized. It's tough for me to comment and say, listen, I have assurances from the CEO that they won't do that. They'll say, so you have one guy who stands to gain the most from this operation who says, don't worry about it. But in effect, they are worried about it. And so the question from me to you is, what if we were to find that some measure of material is reaching that fishery that we did not anticipate getting there, and we didn't know how it was getting there? What would happen to the operation at that point?
Mr. Chair, in response to Representative Gatto's comments and question, first off, let me just clarify the record. I'm not here today to try to convince you or ask you to believe what I say, because you don't know me, and I'm not here to present the facts to support my case. The facts have not all been collected yet, and we haven't designed our project. Nor am I asking you to believe that the Pebble Mine would have no impact, because we haven't designed the mine yet. So it would be premature to make that statement. So I'm not making promises to you other than we will do the best job, spending significant money with the best environmental and engineering teams, design the project, and present the case to the permitting process. State and federal permitting that will take multiple years with hundreds of experts scrutinizing our work. And if at the end of that process we can't prove and convince the agencies, legislators, and stakeholders in the region that this is a project that is safe and that their fears will not materialize, then we don't deserve to get a permit. And what I'm saying is we're ready, willing, and able to spend the $100-plus million. We've already spent $70 million to date with a budget this year of $30-plus, and we're hitting this for the long haul. If we don't do it right and can't convince you through the permitting process, we don't deserve and won't get permits. That's how rigorous the state and federal permitting process is. But we have experience in other jurisdictions with the same types of mines, in jurisdictions that are close to and within highly sensitive fisheries areas that have the same water quality and fish resource and fishing concerns, and mines have been developed safely there. And so I respect the concerns that are raised. Our stakeholder consultation program is soliciting those views and concerns so we can factor it into the proper design of our project, and that's the process we're in the middle of now. So my response to your question would be, sustain those concerns, bring those concerns to the table, and have your constituents bring them to the table during the permitting process once we've defined the project, and scrutinize and question the legitimacy of our work and our design during the permitting process, and the outcome will speak for itself based on the science and the engineering.
I've heard some opponents of the project refer to an SEC statement, which seems to suggest, and you refer to that on page 2 of your letter, that there's some sort of provision that directors and officers wouldn't be subject to suit by U.S. courts. Do you think that that SEC statement may have been taken out of context?
Well, I believe it definitely has been taken out of context, because an erroneous spin has been put on that quotation to create the impression that Canadian executives and directors have a get-out-of-jail-free card. That is patently wrong in law and in practice. And as I say in my letter, it is erroneous to infer from any peculiarity of a securities disclosure that Northern Dynasty Mines is not subject to U.S. or Alaska law, including any related mine development. BC has provisions with the state of Alaska that allows for judgments to be made against BC citizens. So it's patently wrong. It's part of the rhetoric and the misinformation that's being discussed surrounding our project. And the facts speak for themselves. You know, it's kind of interesting. We're kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't. We follow the law and provide these disclosures because we're required to by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and then we get criticized for doing it.
Yeah. Go, Ledoux.
That was talking about insider training, trading and derivative action suits and things of that nature as opposed to environmental catastrophe litigation, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And perhaps germane to that comment, the assets of Pebble Mine, if we're permitted and we build it, look, we're talking about a $2-plus billion capital asset just to build it, not including the road and port and power infrastructure. Those assets reside in the state of Alaska. They're there to support any damages or claim, and the multi-billions of dollars in the ground and the metal are assets. The bond and the cash that we would post for reclamation are assets in the state of Alaska. So there are lots of assets that reside in the state within the American subsidiary that are available to support any kind of a claim or action.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jenkins, in your responses to the 180 questions that the Native community submitted to you, you said that Pebble did not intend to use a chemical pollution mixing zone or to wasn't going to need that. Is that still the case that the mine design is not planning on needing a mixing zone?
There's no simple answer to that, Representative Seaton. The current base case design for the project does not envision a surface water discharge and therefore does not envision the need for a mixing zone. Yes. The project is not finalized in its design, and as you may know, we found a significantly higher grade deposit to the east at greater depth. We're investigating underground mining techniques this year. Whether that engineering effort will result in a change, I cannot predict, but the current intent is no discharge during operation and no mixing zone. That's the best I can say at this stage in the with the information available.
What's the concern about the resolution? We spoke earlier, you know, and it's just a resolution, and then that's an understatement of the session so far. And then it got this fiscal note attached, and then we see these two critical paths. They're concurrent. The legislature would bear the expense of the land use development plan. What's the harm?
Simply put, 3 points. Number one, and maybe I could preface my response by observing that the Department of Natural Resources' response to comments on Monday communicated to me a fair degree of uncertainty and confusion concerning how this unprecedented resolution might be put into action. I didn't come away from that testimony with a clear understanding of whether it truly would be parallel, and if so, how well it could work, and if it did work well, how long it would take. So I don't share the same degree of confidence that it wouldn't impose delays and significant additional hurdles. Having said that, the concerns are just that. Number one, significant risk of delay and adding additional time on an already very long and protracted state and federal review process. Number two, the risk and potential for significant additional expense. Even if the extra costs for DNR were borne by the state, we're expected to cover the costs, and there's our costs as well to deal with that extra time and that extra process. And the third and final critical problem that we have with it is that it removes certainty. We've invested $70 million to date based on an understanding that we were invited into this state. It's state land. It's open to mining. The existing land use plan that was just revised last year confirmed its zone for mine development. That provided us a high degree of certainty. And then in addition, we get a lot of certainty from the known state and federal permitting process, however onerous and robust it is, and expensive and time-consuming. We have certainty because we know what's involved. But this resolution provides a new threshold that creates significant uncertainty. And that threshold is that the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner has to take a report to the legislature at the end of this process and this expense and this time, and it provides an opportunity for the zoning to be changed and for the opportunity to mine to be taken away, independent of what the permit review process says. That is a major threat and injects significant uncertainty. And quite frankly, if we had known that that was the case before we had spent our $70 million, we may have had a different conclusion concerning the decision to acquire this property. Because uncertainty is anathema to good business and is not encouraged in the investment community.
Good answer. Gatto?
We all wish there was uncertainty in everything we do, but in the natural order of things, uncertainty is the rule. And so let me just explore one aspect of that. Some comments were made right from that chair just a few days ago about the message it sends to Wall Street. And I guess what I'm asking you is, do you agree that approving HDR 29 sends a very bad message to Wall Street, which raises, I guess in my mind, the bad message raises the interest rate for borrowing money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gatto, I understand your comment. In answer to your question, yes, unequivocally. I believe that if this resolution was passed, this resolution could be walked into the investment houses and the brokerages in New York, in Montreal, in Toronto, in London, in Paris, in Zurich, the sources of our financings, and could be used to present the case that says Alaska is not open for business, specifically is not open for the mining industry, and Alaska is a bad place to invest. And there are special interest groups who do not want to see Pebble, who are willing to take that risk, even if the collateral damage of such an action could compromise the integrity and the economy of this state. With respect to your comment about risk, I'm not suggesting that we be given a risk-free situation. Sir, we are in the risk business. We have invested $70 million so far, another 30 this year, and tens of millions of dollars more into the future to go through a known permitting process that has an unknown outcome. I think we already have significant uncertainty. Adding another layer of uncertainty could be the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. And I am very alarmed by the risks associated with this resolution.
Any further questions? All right, with that, Mr. Jenkins, we appreciate you spending some time in front of the committee. We'll get another bite at this apple after the Lake and Penn local governing committee chimes in. It is 1 minute before 3. Resource Committee is adjourned. Thank you.